Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Some great games to get to. Golden State and Portland is always an awesome one. That's right up there. Two teams that were in the top five of my own personal League Pass watch rankings. We also have a good win for the Jazz in San Antonio, their first win in 10 straight down there, even with Derek Favors only playing a half and Hayward and Diaw being out. The Prospect Bowl in Philly with Orlando coming away with a last second victory there. And we'll talk a little bit about what is definitely not an overtime classic between Sacramento and Miami. We're sponsored today by CISO, a new sponsor. It is the new ad-free streaming service bringing you hilarious original series, handpicked classics, weeks of stand-up specials, including every episode of SNL, which is awesome. Find out more about them at CISO.com. You can sign up for 2 months free with that Capspace code. And then also NatureBox, which makes snacks that actually taste great and are better for you. You can get 50% off of your first order at naturebox.com/capspace. Before we get to the games, go, we got some news, including we have a trade to announce.
Yay! It was one of those weird things because the way that trade reporting happens sometimes is that it comes a little bit piecemeal. And once you get the first little nugget, you first of all overreact, but also get really excited. And so like the first thing that came out was Woj saying the Thunder have traded for Jeremy Grant. And you're sitting there going, whoa. And then over the course of about 20 minutes, you figured out the rest of the deal.
Yeah, the parameters. A top 20 protected first round pick that then rolls over to 2 second round picks in 2022 and 2023. Unclear how long that goes on. I would imagine maybe it's 2020 and 2021 if it goes to the 2 second round picks in 2022 and 23. Maybe it's protected through 2022 as well. That's a possibility. And of course, Ersan Ilyasova, who makes about $8.4 million, he's getting traded into the Sixers cap space. Danny, your thoughts?
Before we knew the draft pick compensation, I was getting belligerently angry for the Sixers just because it was a strange use of their cap space. And because while Jeremy Grant is not a perfect fit for them, it just seemed like they could get something more for him. But when you saw the draft pick return, this totally makes sense. It's distant, which is hard, and that does diminish the value of it because second round picks at that point, not only because the changes in the scale and all that sort of stuff, but just in terms of present value, you know, it's so distant, is a problem. But we don't know where the Thunder are going to be. I would expect that it's more likely, considering top 20 protection is awfully strong, that they will get the 2 seconds. But that's still a great return for a guy you got in the second who hadn't exactly blown the doors off of anybody during this time.
You know what's interesting about this timing for OKC? What happened yesterday?
They extended a couple guys who can't shoot.
And they also did not extend Robertson.
That's true.
So those two guys to me are pretty similar players. Grant, of course, does not have anywhere near the defensive pedigree that Robertson does. They both can't shoot, although Grant, I think, has a little bit more hope on that, and he's a little bit younger, probably a better offensive player too. But you know, really kind of a stretch four, switchy, athletic type of guy in a very similar mold. So maybe they're viewing him as insurance in case Robertson were to get some crazy offer as a restricted free agent. And aside from that, they actually did something that I think that teams should be doing more of. There's only been a couple of times I can recall that we've had picks that are protected that high. In our mock trade deadline last year, I wanted to do that as basically a way of saying, hey, if this trade works out and we're good, fine, we're willing to give up this pick, but otherwise we're not. You know, I think lottery protected is a little bit different there, because for it to be a top 20 protected pick and to actually go, you have to be pretty good that year. So starting in 2020, that's quite a ways away. Oklahoma City really can't trade any picks now because they already have that 2018 pick that's encumbered to Utah from the Kanter trade. And this, the fact that even the 2 second round picks in 22 and 23, those picks could be pretty good second rounders if the pick doesn't go because it's top 20 protected. You imagine that's because Oklahoma City is going to be bad. So it'll be pretty early on in the first round. So Philly, nice way to add to their potential war chest at a time when you think hopefully all their young talent will have matured and they're actually pretty good. They can bring in some younger talent, and Oklahoma City seems to think that they can do something with Grant's contract. And before we talked, actually, you were saying that maybe some the new extension rules might make this a more palatable deal for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, they might, because you got into this weird place with players that were signed originally to a 4-year contract. And I'm actually working on a piece for the Sporting News on this that will, I'm hoping, be done by next week. And the idea is basically that, you know, with players other than rookie scale guys, when if they go 4 years before a new contract, they're unrestricted. And then if it's 3 years, they're restricted. So you see guys like what happened to Chandler Parsons, though there might have been some, let's call it external factors that led to that. So you see sometimes teams decline a cheap team option because they want that security. Well, if the extension system is non-broken and you can extend those guys, it changes the way you think about it because there you can secure a reasonable deal. And maybe sometimes you even will incorporate something for that extra year, but it's a lot more flexible. You have more options. And with Oklahoma City's lack of cap flexibility, that could be a real positive for them.
Yeah, you would have thought that a team like Houston with Chandler Parsons would have loved to have extended him. But, you know, since you're limited to 107.5% and he was making the minimum, that was never something that's going to happen. Now, assuming that gets bumped up, which we haven't heard for sure yet, but you think would make sense that you can pay players much more in an extension than they were previously making. Now that should allow some of those contracts to become more valuable. I don't know if Jeremy Grant can play. I mean, he's got a lot of raw materials. This, again, fits into that, the old Sam Presti playbook of getting guys you don't necessarily fit that well, that he thinks are talented, that they think they can develop. I think they're going to miss Ersan Ilyasova this year, though.
I think they will, too, especially if Sabonis ends up missing any time, just because they don't really have another guy who can do
well,
that.
Well, Sabonis isn't any good right now anyway.
That's also true. But something I wanted to mention,
he's getting like the Noah Vonleh Memorial,
yeah,
start the first 5 minutes of the half and then never come back in power forward starts.
And Ilyasova's been underutilized by them. I think he can take on a bigger role. He has this weird thing. We could eventually go through his trade path. I think he's been on five teams in the last 17 months. It is kind of amazing. And a couple of those trades were for nothing. This one was not for nothing, but in other trades it was. And the other, so the thing that I like about Jeremy Grant, and this is a strange thing to kind of key on with a trade, is that I prefer him defensively as a four. I don't love him as a man-to-man perimeter defender, but I like him as a help guy kind of in that role. And that makes sense with Enes Kanter, because Jeremy Grant can't shoot. Enes Kanter can kind of. I mean, you don't necessarily want to keep him like living in the corner because he's such a good back-to-the-basket guy. But there could be an interplay there that works, and you want a weak side shot blocker when you have Enes Kanter as your center, because that is a responsibility that he is not good at. So that could really work. And you get him for basically nothing for 2 years. Jeremy Grant's contract isn't even fully guaranteed for this season yet. And I mean, I assume that will end up being, that will manifest itself, and it will be. But it's, you know, if you're a team that doesn't have a lot of mechanisms by which to improve, and these picks are so distant, you know, whether you want to take the kind of Machiavellian idea of Sam Presti doesn't know if he'll still have a job by then, or if you want to take just the practical perspective of, you know, the time is now for Oklahoma City as long as they have Russ, then, you know, you can go for that without thinking about those consequences.
Another non-trivial aspect of this, Oklahoma City basically sheds about $7 million bucks in salary, and they also now could go to either create a trade exception that's about 7.4 million, or they could go down to about 7.2 million under the cap if they wanted to just use space. So they could take on some money if they wanted to now, and maybe try to pick up an asset to replace this from a team that's trying to shed, you know, someone along the lines of maybe like the Clippers, they're trying to dump some cash that are in the tax. Only two teams right now projected to be in the tax, of course, after that huge cap increase this year, but also it just saves you $7 million in cash if you, and that, especially with a roster that could start getting expensive again with some of these rookie extensions, if they bring back Roberson, maybe that's going to be a consideration for Oklahoma City as well. And Philly was way below the salary floor, picking up an asset here, and they supposedly think that Ilyasova can help them maybe a little bit while Simmons is out. But, you know, I think that I don't want Saric and Simmons not playing so they can put Ilyasova out there, and they shouldn't be playing Saric or Simmons at the three that much either. But at least, you know, if you want to play Simmons at the three, this allows you to get a little bit more shooting on the floor to do that. And Ilyasova, a good team defender, can take some charges, space the floor for Embiid. But, you know, there's a reason he's been traded a billion times now in this contract too, because he's not that good.
Am I required to say Darth now every time I mean to say Dearth because I said it once the wrong way and it was funny?
If you want to talk about the Darth of quality threes and fours on Oklahoma City's roster, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to talk about the Darth of quality kind of depth players on the Sixers right now. I mean, that was something that reared its head in the game that we will discuss a little bit, is that they just don't have enough guys right now. A lot of that is due to injury, you know, Simmons being out, being out, and just having another guy who can play basketball when they're still going to be bad enough that they don't have to worry about, oh, what if we win too many games? That can be something that really helps them and builds them and gets them into some competitive games. And it would have been nice if they could have won this game, and I think Ilyasova would have made the difference.
Let's roll through a little bit more news here. One of the moves that our friend Fred Katz reported, no stretch of Ronnie Price. So his $2.5 million next year is just going to go on the Thunder's books. It can close the door on that inexplicable signing. But considering that they extended these guys, they're very likely operating over the cap next year. Better to just get all that out of the way next year instead of having it going on to the books.
Unless they pay tax on it. Years. But I think they'll be okay.
Yeah, it does seem...
That would be spectacular if that was like what pushed them over the luxury tax line.
Yeah. Also, I have a correction to make. I apologize to Dwayne Dedman. He did, in fact, get a qualifying offer from the Magic. And his representative, Brandon Greer, informed me that the Magic revoked that qualifying offer at his agent's request because they had signed Biombo and just didn't really have a use for him anymore. So I had misremembered him not getting a qualifying offer. It got pulled. I wondered why the Magic pulled that. You and I think were actually critical of it. And it seems like they were just basically doing him a favor at that point to pull it. And obviously, I'm sure he's very, very happy in San Antonio. Some injury news here. Ricky Rubio out indefinitely with a sprained elbow. And I'm no Jeff Stotts, but from what I can recall, these sorts of injuries are usually kind of 2 to 4 week type of things. Like this is something that like Jimmy Butler had 2 years ago. And I think the Wolves are going to be in big trouble without him. I don't know if Dunn is ready. They played Memphis's JV squad today with Gasol and with Conley just sitting the game out. And they got completely wrecked. So this wasn't a good test, but I think Minnesota could struggle with Dunn and Tyus Jones without Rubio. They really have not been able to be good without Rubio on the floor really at any time in the last couple of years.
It will certainly be a challenge for them. And I hate the indefinite diagnosis. It's just something that makes me uncomfortable. As you know, there are people who have a better estimate with this, but it just always makes me a little bit queasy, especially when it's with somebody I enjoy watching so much and who has been so vital to their offensive and defensive to a point relevance over the last few years.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where they're just gonna have to wait for the swelling to go down to get an idea of really like how long it's gonna take to heal. Alec Burks had what is now a third procedure on his foot and ankle. This is a debridement by specialist Dr. Martin O'Malley. He had tried to get back. He really probably tried to come back too soon, frankly, and then was not right. Had another procedure from that broken ankle, basically, that he suffered last year. Had another procedure in April when the Jazz season ended. Was not able to get back to where he wasn't having any soreness, and then he just had to have another surgery. He's going to be out indefinitely now, too, and you really have to wonder if this could just be a totally lost season for Burks. I think it's really starting to trend that way at this point, and that this could be something that might be really a career-changing injury from him when he got undercut by Paul Pierce on what was a kind of a borderline dirty play last year going to the basket.
It's such a shame because he also kind of had his place in their on their team swept up from under his feet. You know, that's something that can happen, especially when you're out as long as Burks has been now and apparently will be now. But, you know, it looked like he was, as a perimeter defender, especially as a swingman defender, that would have a nice role with them. Sometimes, you know, playing a little bit more with the starters if you need him there, but oftentimes being more of a linchpin of the second unit. And, you know, now they have to treat it a little bit differently, even though he's still going to be under contract.
For the Bulls, Michael Carter-Williams had what looked like it could be a nasty knee injury. And Nick Friedel was saying there was a lot of fear that it could be worse. It was diagnosed initially as a knee sprain. MRI showed that he has a bone bruise with no ligament damage to his knee and also a left wrist sprain, looking like 4 to 6 weeks out for him. And so Denzel Valentine now will get a little bit of a look as a backup point guard, maybe playing alongside of Dwayne Wade. And we also might see actually Jerry and Grant become active, which he's really been sitting on the sideline for a while. Could also just mean more time for Isaiah Cannon as well. I always mispronounce that. Isaiah Cannon, he's shot very well in these first few games. He's a nice fit. He's been closing a lot of second quarters with some of their shooters or as to provide some shooting with some of their non-shooters on the floor. Anything else we got before we get to the games?
So Rodney Stuckey doesn't have a tear. He had an MRI, but he will be out several weeks. So, you know, Indiana has some depth at the two guard spot, but they will miss him.
Yeah, I think if it leads to CJ Miles playing a little bit more, that's a good thing. That might mean more of Monte Ellis playing the one with the second unit for them. I don't really think that this hurts them a ton. Maybe also means some more Glenn Robinson the third minutes. See if he can kind of establish his career a little bit for the Pacers.
Yeah, seems fair.
All right, before we get to Warriors Blazers, let's talk about CISO. For a long time, I was looking for this one really awesome Saturday Night Live skit. It was the old super fans. I'm from Chicago. We, of course, loved them. The Bears and Polish Sausage. And I could never find it, you know, on Hulu or even like on YouTube anywhere. It was basically this trivia game with the super fans that was like preempting a fake Super Bowl. One of like the funniest things I've ever seen, especially for a Chicagoan. Could never find it. And now, because of CISO, I can finally watch it. It's a new ad-free streaming service bringing you hilarious original series, handpicked classics, stand-up specials. It's got every episode of SNL. It's got The Tonight Show, Late Night, The Day After They Air, classics like 30 Rock, Parks and Rec, Saved by the Bell, which total dorks like me really loved growing up in the 90s, The Original Office, the whole Monty Python catalog, and also they curate some of the best big names in comedy who are up and coming. So it's really a fantastic deal for people who love comedy, a great supplement to some of the other streaming services that has content you can't get on those. And right now, listeners can get CISO free for 2 months when you use promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. CAPSPACE is easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. CISO.com, promo code CAPSPACE to get your 2 free months. This game was an entertaining yarn, as always, between these two teams, but the Warriors really had their first game where they looked like what everyone thought they were going to be this year. They destroyed the Blazers in what was an epic third quarter.
Yeah, it really was that third quarter, because there were some question marks early on. I openly doubted Curry's defense of Damian Lillard in the early stretches of this game, but people will focus justifiably on Curry's absolutely insane scoring outburst in that. But in some ways, the larger structural takeaway that I had from that third quarter was just how good they were defensively.
Yeah, that was huge. And this was more what I thought. I thought that the defense, especially with someone like Pachulia in there or West at center, was going to be pretty average. And really, even in that third quarter, whenever they attacked Pachulia, they were able to get buckets. So that's been a constant theme. And in a game they ended up killing, Pachulia still was just barely in the positive. But once he went out of the game and they started playing Green at center, and then they brought in West to close out the quarter, it was huge. I thought that Green and Iguodala, both of them showed a lot more fire. Ian Clark actually played some excellent defense on Dame Lillard. Just their getting of loose balls, they were much more intense. Green actually cited after the game some comments by Lillard in the media saying that the defense just wasn't the same for Golden State a couple of days ago, and Green and Iguodala in particular were able to show that no, they actually could still bring it to some extent. Although I will say that Portland probably missed a lot of open shots, but there were open shots by the guys that the Warriors wanted shooting them, guys like Harkless and Aminu, and those guys, a lot of what Portland is going to wax and wane based on what those guys are able to bring them from downtown. And in this one, those guys combined for 0-for-7 on threes and 4 out of 18 from the field overall.
Spiritually, this game defensively was a direct continuation of the playoff series last year when the Warriors did exactly the same thing. Like they basically made the decision that you want to limit Dame and CJ and presumably their centers and let Aminu and Harkless take some of those shots. And sometimes they'll make them, sometimes they won't. And, you know, that was a well-fought, hard-contested five-game series, but overall that tactic worked. And the Warriors have the personnel to do it. And another takeaway in this game, just because it seemed like it fit more in scheme, and also because it was outside of that third quarter a little bit, was Durant looked more like what I kind of think his eventual defensive role is that he's just kind of another rim protector, another help defender who can take some of the load off of Draymond in a way. You know, Harrison Barnes deserves a lot of credit for what he did last year defensively, but if Durant can bring that kind of an element to this defense, especially in the small lineups, it can be a major tactical thing, maybe in a way that was more paralleling the Megadeth lineup that was so dominant in games 3 and 4 in Oklahoma City last year.
Yeah, Durant, I thought, has actually been pretty disappointing defending on the perimeter so far this year. Just has not really been that great at getting out on shooters, but he has been fantastic protecting the rim. He was in this game. Green as well was pretty good. Zaza at least was a little bit better than he has been, although he's still kind of a traffic cone. But they finally really got the other team to start shooting poorly, and a lot of it was due to good pressure. 11 out of 25 within 8 feet for Portland in this game. What were your takeaways from this one from Portland's standpoint?
In the first half, Lillard looked fantastic. I mean, especially when Curry was on him, but he was getting where he wanted to. He was drawing fouls. He was finishing at the rim, which is something you and I have talked about, but it has been consistently impressive during the course of this. But, and I feel a little bit guilty bringing up this point, because even though I thought it at the same time, you did bring it up to me privately first, which is the idea of whether Mason Plumlee is the best center for this starting unit.
Well, they don't have any great options, and Plumlee did have 6 assists. But I mean, there was one play that I recall where they threw it to Zaza, and Zaza was just dead to rights, threw up a pump fake, and Plumlee did this pathetic kind of jump out of the way and try to put two hands in the air and just let Zaza score on him. It was just the type of play that you would think, man, they just need someone better to protect the rim when you've got not the best defensive players at the point of attack. And I was like, oh, Ed Davis is much better. And then, of course, he got smoked as well and was unable to finish inside. They put in Noah Vonleh for the end of the third quarter. He didn't look ready for prime time either. And so with all the money that they spent, I always felt like center was their biggest need. They still have not really addressed that. And their support players, when they weren't hitting threes, Dame was 4 out of 10, CJ was 2 out of 5, and everyone else was 1 out of 11 from 3-point range through the competitive portion of this game in the first three quarters. So it was a little bit of a reversion for this team. I thought that Lillard was good, got a little bit shot happy at times in the third quarter, but was excellent at drawing fouls. He's actually just turned all overnight into a great flopper, and he has been finishing better at the rim. Most of the shots that he missed were just really tough jump shots, and CJ was good too, 6 out of 12, but no one else really was able to bring it except Turner, who was 5 out of 6, but that he was just hitting his mid-rangers. It's not like he was doing anything different, and he was negative 30 despite having 14 points in this game.
While you never want to condemn a team, and it's, I wouldn't call this a condemnation, one of the aspects of Portland is, you know, like, maybe comparing them to the best of the best isn't really a fair thing. You know, like, that's not really their ceiling at this point. They're a good team. They had a great season last year, and part of the aspect of why neither of us thought they were going to improve massively on that is the age part, but another part is just that the structural reasons that they succeeded and failed last year were largely the same. And internal improvement, unless somebody like Vonleh takes a major leap, is not there. And so, yeah, they're going to struggle with teams like the Warriors. And if they want to have these lofty winning the Western Conference aspirations, they can. But just like Toronto, who is probably in that situation where, you know, they're running up against a buzzsaw in Cleveland for the foreseeable future, I think Raptors, Blazers fans, you know, if that's as good as they do, that's an awfully good team, especially considering where they were a year ago.
Yeah, but a little disheartening early on. They ended up losing by double digits at home to the Clippers, and now getting waxed like this by Golden State, having no answer for Curry in that third quarter, I thought was, it's got to be a little bit disheartening for this team that maybe, I mean, we didn't feel like they were going to turn the corner necessarily, but any team is going to go into it with big aspirations, and clearly they did that last year and really outstripped what everyone thought they were going to be able to do. I mean, so the damage on this one, some of the stats, I mean, really, it was all just about shooting. The rebounding was about the same, turnovers were about the same, but the Warriors put up 100 points on 80 possessions through three quarters, and the Blazers only managed 73, and they shot poorly at the rim, and they shot poorly from downtown, and despite getting a decent number of attempts in both areas, and that was just mostly good contested shots, but also just their shooters outside of Dame and CJ not being able to hit at all.
Well, I do want to note, though, that the Warriors actually did, in the competitive portion of this game, have a rebounding advantage, but a big part of that is attributable to the Warriors just having fewer offensive rebounds and more defensive rebounds. You know, generally speaking, that team gets more of those opportunities. I mean, I think the Warriors, even because the team rebounds were relatively close, I think it was 36-27 in the first three quarters. And that is a pretty sizable advantage. But when the Warriors shot almost 56% in those times, it's just there are fewer opportunities for the Blazers to get what they're trying to get.
So Steph had that 23 in the third, really just got going with some crazy threes where he was kind of not even grabbing the ball cleanly, and then just throwing something up when the defense was frozen by the fact that he wasn't able to grasp the ball cleanly as he tried to go up the first time. Do you think that he looks like he did last year to you right now, or is there a subtle difference there?
There is such a strong parallel to game four of the second round series, where he had some crazy shots and he put some stuff up, but there were other fundamentals that didn't look right. His defense on Lillard is one. Another is the last possession of the second quarter, which we lose sight of now because of what immediately followed it. He had Ed Davis on a switch and basically did a million stutter steps and then did a kind of a sidestep fadeaway to deep two to end the possession. And
yeah, so here's the problem.
That is not Stephen Curry.
Here's the problem, though. Like, they are just doing a bad job of giving him enough space to work on
also
those
true.
Plays. And it happened even during his run. He wasn't able to get a good shot against Plumlee either because Draymond Green was just like Zaza Pachulia was just trying to post up when he's got ISO'd against Mason Plumlee, and Draymond Green is standing 4 feet away from him at the top of the key. Like, you need to get out of his way. He needs to get to the top of the key instead of trying to be in the corner where you just don't have enough room to operate out past the three-point line so that he can force guys to overcommit to the three-pointer and drive past him and have enough room. And so, because he's not the type of guy who's going to just blow by you with pure quickness, you got to get the guy going forward so that then you can go blow past him, and you have to be at the three-point line to do that and have enough space to go laterally and change direction. So I think part of it is just they haven't been putting him in as good a position to succeed there on some of those ISOs. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. It's too early for me to say. I mean, he's definitely had some really nice moments for sure. And he may just not get the ball quite as much for us to ever really know the answer to the question of, oh, if he had just come back this year without KD, like what kind of a season would he have had? That was one of the biggest disappointments to me in the KD signing, was I wanted to see what he might be capable of, whether how much of a fluke that unbelievable season last year was, whether he could actually be that same guy in the playoffs this year. So we may never see that, but I think it, positive signs at least, but he just has had like a kind of a lot of turnovers, a lot of plays where he's looked bad, maybe more so than he did last year.
Not something that we should dwell on. And I agree with all that, and was actually working on a piece for The Athletic on that idea, which before this, when I was doing the player analysis, it was about kind of the idea of Curry's sacrifice this year. But I feel like the story of this game cannot be told without a quick mention of Ian Clark and Jake Layman.
Yes.
Ian Clark had 16 points in the second quarter, eventually had a career high of 22. Jake Layman had 17 in the fourth. Not sure either of those things moves the needle long term, but still a part of the story of this game.
Yeah, Clark actually saved the Warriors. They were down 21-14, and maybe they would have come back without his heroics. But yeah, going 8-for-8 for him, and he got them right back. I think they went on like a 10-0 run right after he came into the game. Clay Thompson continues to struggle. He's like 3 out of 27 on threes now for the season or something. He's really has been rushing a shot, got into foul trouble in this game also with some kind of dumb fouls. But yeah, and Layman, I mean, if he shoots like that, yeah, he could potentially be a good player. He's got a million guys in front of him in Portland, but I'm sure he kind of looks like the closest thing to like a Portland hipster on the roster, so he got some pretty big cheers for dropping that 17. Again, it must be noted, like Looney playing the three and then like two centers for the Warriors for most of that time.
Yeah, James Michael McAdoo, not exactly the greatest guy at closing out on a four.
That is true. A few other notes on this one. Andre Iguodala does not look good finishing layups, and it's been a problem that started to arise more and more as he's just been able to dunk less. He's never had great touch on those. And I actually did the math last year. He only shot 51% at the rim on non-dunks. Now, I don't know how that compares. I haven't done that math really for anyone else. So it might be that a lot of guys who dunk, there's a reason you're shooting a layup. It's because it's contested. That could be part of the issue, but something to watch that he could struggle finishing at the rim a little bit. He gets stripped a lot down low too on those plays that happened to him today.
Well, he also hesitates a lot, and that is an underrated contributing factor to what was in a lot of ways the defining play of Game 7 of the finals, is that if he hadn't hesitated, LeBron doesn't get there.
Oh, I don't know. I thought that was just a nice play by, I think it was J.R. Smith, to make him pull the ball back. So
pulled it back anyway. That's just the way you watch it. He did that even in today's game when the contest wasn't as strong.
We'll agree to disagree on that one. Let's get to Utah and San Antonio. But first, this word from NatureBox. We are, of course, involved in this little bet right now to see who can lose the most fat. And I still every once in a while have the need to snack. And so NatureBox is a decent way to do that. I've been having some of their beef jerky products, and my girlfriend, under no such restrictions, has really been enjoying them as well. She got these little mini Belgian waffles. She's basically been torturing me with how good all this stuff is. These garlic parmesan crisps, which are really good, that she has been enjoying. She like plowed through like all five of the bags that we got already in like the first week. So she really enjoys them. She wants to get some more too. And it's definitely made out of natural ingredients, which certainly some of the store's brands are not. So the way to go and check them out, and I think you'll find as you go through your some of these things are going to sound irresistible, naturebox.com. Check out their snack catalog. And actually, you probably want to go to naturebox.com/capspace because that'll let them know that you came from us and get you 50% off your first order. So it's naturebox.com/capspace, 50% off your first order. Go check out some of the stuff that they have. I think you'll really... you or your significant other will be very interested in a lot better snacks than you're just going to find in the aisle at the grocery store. Naturebox.com/capspace. This was really a titanic win for a Utah team that had a very difficult early schedule. They already lost on the road in a tough loss at Portland. They got beaten pretty handily by the Clippers a bit ago, beat the Lakers at home and not a particularly convincing style. And then they took it to San Antonio really in a fantastic fashion, despite the fact that Derek Favors only played the first half. Gordon Hayward, of course, is still out. He's going to try to come back in a couple of weeks or so. And then Boris Diaw was resting for his what would have been his first game back in San Antonio. How surprised were you by this result? A Jazz win, 106-91, although it wasn't quite that bad. It turned into a little bit of a blowout in the last minute or so.
So when I was compiling League Pass Alert this week, I was very conflicted because I am a big believer in the Jazz, and I thought these games would both be very interesting intellectually from a basketball perspective, and I thought they would be competitive. And then I'm sitting there watching them disappoint last week. I'm sitting there and going, oh, I'm just going to keep... And this was the game I kept on moving down. The Spurs are great at home, all those sorts of things. And then they really did put it together, and a guy that I want to single out for praise is former Spur and periodic butt of jokes because of the guy he ended up being traded for, Kawhi Leonard, George Hill, who was great in this game.
9 of 13 from the field for Hill, 3 of 5 on threes, 7 assists, plus 7. He had 22 points, and really, he was the guy who kept them afloat. The Jazz were up by 4 at halftime. The Spurs came out of the gates really hot, actually took a 3-point lead. Everyone in the building, I'm sure, thought, like, oh, here's the run. The Jazz are not going to be able to respond. And Hill hit a couple of shots to keep him in it. And then he had 8 straight points in the fourth quarter to, again, get the Jazz out to the lead that they were able to retain. And Hill was just fantastic. Like, he was operating in pick and roll. He was pulling up for threes off the dribble in pick and roll, getting to the rim, hitting nice floaters off the pick and roll. Just looked like a good, solid NBA pick and roll point guard with good length and athleticism. And of course, he always brings it on defense as well. And I was just thinking that, man, Pacers fans have got to be shaking their heads wondering where this was. But it was there in 2014-15, only for about 40 games because he was hurt. And it's why this talent that he has was just why that decision to bring in Monte Ellis and then trade him away for Jeff Teague didn't make a lot of sense to me, because I think Hill is just a better even offensive player than Ellis, or maybe even Teague, with what he's been able to do early on here. He saved the Jazz with some of their primary creators off the dribble, just not available right now.
A big part of why we praised that trade for the Jazz was the idea that Hill doesn't have to be the guy, that he can play off ball. He's a great catch and shoot guy, underrated generally in that, except by us. And, you know, that matters in terms of everything. But what he has shown during this stretch, without Hayward most importantly, but Diaw can create as well, and Alec Burks can create, you know, is that he can do a lot of that more traditional high usage point guard stuff at a level. And I mean, the fact that he combines that with defense, Tony Parker, you know, only took 5 shots in this game. You know, you have a lot of different things that you can attribute to defense, but I thought he did a really nice job, and they need him more right now, and he is delivering.
It was an excellent bench performance from the Jazz as well. Shelvin Mack, 6 of 9 from the field. He had 14 points. Trey Lyles, 15 points on 15 shooting possessions, but he actually had a key stretch as well in that third quarter. It really was causing some problems for LaMarcus Aldridge with at the three-point line, forcing him to close out and then blowing by him. The Jazz were getting some nice looks off of that. Now, Lyles did probably get lucky during that stretch on the other end because he couldn't guard Aldridge in pick and pop, and Aldridge was just missing his really reliable 16-footer. quarter, and he ended up still a solid, efficient game with 21 points on 18 shooting possessions, but actually I think missed a lot of wide open shots he would like to have back. For the Spurs, I mean, we don't even need to talk about Kawhi Leonard anymore. 30 points in 36 minutes, only 20 shooting possessions, 5 of 7 on threes, got to the foul line for 5 shots, his usual 2 steals. He was fantastic again, and the Jazz didn't have much answer for him. But Leonard was not able to keep him in it late as the Spurs really went through a scoring drought. He kind of had a couple turnovers where he kicked it out of bounds, wasn't able to hit some pretty tough shots. So the Jazz did well defending him down the stretch. And the other thing, we thought that Jonathan Simmons should be starting. He was just a better fit than Kyle Anderson was, while Simmons immediately crashed back to earth, 1 out of 7 in 29 minutes. Although he was still in the black for the Spurs, Kyle Anderson came off the bench and only had 2 points.
I dug out a stat just for you, inspired by this game, and it was the Spurs' defensive rating during the 14 minutes that David Lee played.
He was negative 20 in those 14 minutes, so I'm guessing it's going to be rather high.
141.7.
That's bad.
Yeah, especially when their offensive rating was like 70-something.
Yeah, and I think that the Jazz really, because they didn't play any, but I mean, they played Favors some, but that was only in the first half. That's just part of his planned rest to only play in the first half. And I think he's good with the back-to-back coming up tomorrow. But other than that, the Jazz were playing with someone as a stretch four or just a combo forward, someone who could shoot threes. And that is something that David Lee is going to struggle to guard.
It is. And you know, that is a situation with them. However, David Lee does not need to be a major part of their rotation when you have guys like Deadman and Gasol and everything else like that. I mean, they will use him from time to time, but you know, they have other players they could try.
Yeah, Gasol, he had 20 when LaMarcus Aldridge rested in Miami over the weekend, but then was back to a smaller role today, only 8 points in 26 minutes for Gasol. And again, you know, we played that audio on Thursday's program. Be interesting to see how he deals with somewhat of a smaller role, but he actually didn't play too badly in this one. I thought he wasn't the problem, at least for the Spurs in this one. Dante Exum, he definitely is rightfully behind Shelvin Mack in the point guard rotation right now. He's really playing more at the two. He did have 4 block shots, but 3 turnovers. And really the thing that's holding Exum back right now is just his handle. You know, he's quick in a straight line, but when his initial move gets stopped, he doesn't have the handle. He'll turn it over a lot of times. He doesn't have the handle to still control the ball and even back it out successfully or continue under the rim, much less actually make a counter move. We talked about this on yesterday's program, that if he's going to become their starting point guard next year, he's got to really, really tighten up that handle. He is not there yet by any means. Another interesting thing about this game, the Jazz got 2 offensive rebounds to 30 defensive rebounds for the Spurs, and the Spurs had 4 offensive rebounds to 37 defensive rebounds. So clearly the same philosophy at work in this one for both teams.
Well, and unsurprisingly, I think these are 2 of the best teams in terms of transition defense for that exact reason, that they're making that trade-off. And kudos to Rudy Gobert for not celebrating his significant extension with taking a ton of shots. He only had 4 attempts from the field.
Yeah, the real culprit, though, was the Spurs just going scoreless in the final 3:47. And Trey Lyles was able to do a decent enough job defensively. Joe Johnson actually was guarding Kawhi Leonard. And while he's not that quick, Joe at least is strong enough to keep from getting knocked back on some of those jump shots that Kawhi likes to shoot, where he'll create space with his shoulder. I'm not going to put a ton of stock in, like, oh, this is a crisis for the Spurs, though. They missed a lot of shots. The Jazz were 15 out of 31 on threes. Guys like Mac and Hill were just going crazy from downtown. So I don't think this is really the end of the world for the Spurs. The Jazz just played an excellent game, played some great defense against a team that had been rolling. But, you know, that's just what's going to happen sometimes, even for good teams. And the Jazz are good. They're going to stay in it most games against just about anybody.
Do we want to go to a less well-played game?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Sacramento and Miami first, although you could easily have been talking about Orlando and Philly.
Which is what I was intending to talk about, but it applies to both.
Yeah, I picked this one up with about 5 minutes left in the game, and it was just really ugly. Most notable, Cousins getting 6 fouls in the fourth quarter. The Kings were up most of the, or I'm sorry, the Miami was up most of the way. Rudy Gay actually shot them back into it. But as so often will happen in those situations, then it just devolves into, oh, we're just going to go to the hot guy and ISO him. And unless you're just one of the unbelievable ISO scorers in this game, and even then, just giving the ball to somebody because they're hot, that's the best way to make it so they're not hot anymore, you know, to not run any offense. The Kings just are really going to struggle to score, especially without Cousins in the game. And they had a Flalo. Garrett Temple was closing at the two. Ty Lawson, I mean, none of those guys really can score at all. And then when Cousins fouled out, it was Kufos in the overtime. And then they really weren't going to score. It was just give the ball to Gay. And that's our only hope in this one.
So I believe we are on the same page that the last foul on Cousins, which was this huge circumstance because both Cousins and Whiteside had five fouls and there was a direct interaction between the two of them. I felt that it should not have been called an offensive foul. I think it was a defensive foul on Whiteside. Do you agree with that?
I did at first, and I actually tweeted to that effect. And of course, as any ref-based tweet will, it got a billion retweets, or maybe like 50 more accurately. But the Heat broadcast showed from the baseline angle that Cousins actually put his left arm on top of the shoulder of Whiteside, preventing Whiteside from bringing his left arm up to contest the shot. And that's what the baseline official saw. And I thought it actually, once I saw that angle, which the Kings TV, I don't think showed until the beginning of overtime.
Which is probably how I missed it, because I think I had the Kings feet.
Yeah. It looked really bad, but they showed all the angles from the back where it looked like he just kind of kept his arm in and didn't push off at all. But in fact, he was actually grabbing Whiteside's left arm. And so, yeah, that would have been an and one that would have put the Kings up three. Instead, they went to Miami, came back down. They did a Waiters ISO, got a switch of him, I think, on a Rudy Gay, and just got a terrible fadeaway. And then, of course, the Kings, with 10 seconds left, didn't go with no timeout. Instead, they called timeout to then run a terrible ISO with Rudy Gay, and Rudy shot it so late that he didn't even leave chance for an offensive rebound. He airballed a three going to his left on Justice Winslow, just not a good advantage. At least they could have run a small pick and roll early on to try to get someone a little bit smaller onto Gay where he would have the matchup advantage. He does not have the advantage on Winslow. And then the Kings were completely out of gas. They actually ended up losing 108-96. And Cousins falling out, of course, it was a disaster. He again had 30 points on 8 of 16 from the field, 14 out of 18 from the line. So an efficient performance from him again. And he was one of the few guys you'll see who's actually really able to beast Whiteside. But other than that, I mean, the Kings just were not able to be efficient. 5 out of 23 on threes. Really, they don't have anybody who's a great three-point shooter. Ben McLemore, who had been playing well, he was only 1 out of 7.
And while the Kings are meaningfully better and deeper than they were last year, they're going to be dancing on a razor's edge almost the whole season just because they're so dependent on a small number of guys. And having Darren Collison will certainly help that just because they can generate more consistent offense. But, you know, they are really dependent on Cousins and those days like today when Rudy Gay can shoot them back in the game. And, you know, that's what leads to a team being generally below playoff caliber unless those things hit more often than they often do.
Waiters did play well. He had 20 points on 14 shots. Dragic had 25 points on 14 shots. Tyler Johnson was excellent in the overtime. He had 22 points. And then everyone else on the Heat was totally broke. Winslow, 3 out of 15. He really just cannot hit anything outside of the paint, although he did have 7 assists in this one. And then Whiteside, he was in foul trouble most of the game. Shot only 6 out of 13, which is really bad for him. They've been trying to post him up a fair amount. And he also had 5 turnovers. He just is not a good post-up player. I mean, maybe they're trying to keep him happy, keep him engaged, but he just doesn't have the balance. He'll try to go up. He gets knocked off balance. He's always on the verge of traveling down there in the post. I mean, unless he's just got incredibly deep position, I don't think that him posting up is going to be effective.
Yeah, you get no disagreement from me there.
Now let's move on to a game that, I mean, I always enjoy these Philly games just because Embiid was involved. He's actually going to sit out tomorrow on the second night of a back-to-back in Charlotte. Jahlil Okafor didn't play in this one due to his restrictions coming back from his knee issue. He's going to play tomorrow. But Embiid, again, looked pretty good. What were your thoughts on his performance?
He is a straight five in that way. I mean, I think that the Sixers are still looking to do a little bit too much new agey stuff with him, but he's so good at those traditional center stuff. He had a nice job in terms of shot blocking, in terms of rebounding. Like, you always noticed him out there. And Orlando, while Vooch probably isn't the best matchup to handle Embiid for a lot of different reasons, especially, on the glass, he's a big guy, and Embiid at certain moments just manhandled him, and that is something that you can't get very often from a big dude.
Yeah, there was one play where Embiid faced him up from about 17 on the right baseline, took a couple of dribbles, and Vooch is he's not a small man, and he just got knocked back, and Embiid just went right in for the layup. Embiid's straight post-ups still are not that fantastic. I mean, he has shown a little bit in terms of nice turnaround jump shots, but he's not quite that smooth getting into it. I mean, I think sometimes it would be nice if he could just go straight up with his shots instead of having to go for some kind of dream shake type of thing, because especially against someone like Vucevic, he really is going to have the length and athleticism advantage. You can just jump right over a guy like that.
And you'll get fouls.
Yeah. Embiid also had four turnovers and two killer ones towards the end. One where he was trying to post up on Biombo, and kudos to Frank Vogel for actually putting in Biombo as a defensive replacement for Nick Vucevic. That was something that cost the Magic a couple of games last year that Skiles didn't do down the end of games, and he put Biombo in, and Biombo immediately forced Embiid into a travel. And then the next time down, as Philly was just desperately trying to score, they had a 4-point lead in the final minute, they threw it to Embiid up top, and he tried to just like put someone in the mix off the dribble and ended up just losing the ball. And the Magic might have even had a fast break if they hadn't taken a timeout instead. So it was those two turnovers down the end ended up being somewhat fatal, although overall, again, it was a promising performance from Embiid, especially his four shot blocks. Like, if you try to go up underneath and you don't have a running start, if you're just going to try and power up with him around, like, he just engulfs those type of plays. Like, you have no chance.
And he's going to get even better at them with time. And I think in some ways the second turnover in that final minute was more concerning, just because it didn't seem like where he was really going for something. Because I asked people, like, what was he going for? And most people kind of seemed to say, like, a free throw line jumper. It's like, that's not a great goal of a possession for a kind of guy with his skill set. You want to do something a little bit different. And, the Sixers crunch time execution was an issue last year that didn't really rear its head much, though we talked about it a fair amount when it did. And, they are going to have to get some stuff in place, because now they actually have talent and they can, they have guys like Saric who had a really nice game today. And so you want to maximize what you can get out of them and really build some stuff in. So these guys have expectations. And one, it's going to sound like a really weird parallel to make, but when Steve Kerr came in with the Warriors, one of the biggest changes he made was the idea of expectations on offense. And I think what the Sixers are going to need at some point in the next couple of years before they get good is the idea that they can get better shots than they're satisfied with right now.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And some of the looks that they got out of timeouts, I mean, both of those Embiid plays were out of timeouts that Brett Brown called. It should be noted though that Embiid had like an unbelievable block of a left-handed hook shot by Vucevic. That's not a shot that just about anybody can get to. That was fantastic. He got on the offensive glass and was able to get a foul and make a couple of free throws to help them build that 4-point lead. Lady set a monster screen. The Sixers, I think, had like three jumpers in a row down the last few minutes that any one of which could have put the game away, that like literally went in and out. So it was a tough luck loss for the Sixers. And then on the final play, they actually were able to get what looked like a steal. Embiid was going for the ball and somehow they just weren't able to pick it up. It rolled right to Ibaka under the rim. And then TJ McConnell, in a desperation, dangerous play, was rightly called for a flagrant foul because he just jumped on the back of Serge Ibaka and like tackled him as he was trying to go up for the shot. It looked like Serge might have even injured his wrist, but it seemed like he was okay. We haven't heard anything on that, and Serge was able to make those shots.
Can we have a very short Danny soapbox time, because there was something about this that really bothered me?
Is the soapbox itself going to be short, or like the amount of time that you're speaking?
Both. So I had people, because I called it, because it was a technical foul, it was dangerous. It was a dangerous play. And I had numerous people, including people who I respect, say, well, it wasn't a flagrant foul, or trying to mitigate it by the idea of the circumstance. That is not the way that works. A flagrant foul is a flagrant foul. It doesn't matter if it's there. You can say
it was a dangerous play. Like, you could have very easily injured Ibaka.
Like, you can say that it was justified, but that's something very different from saying it's not a flagrant foul, because well,
The rule exists to deter that exact kind of behavior where you're going to get guys killed. Like, I mean, McConnell injured himself as well. So yeah, if all you can do is flagrant foul, the idea is to not have guys flagrant foul because it doesn't pay off. They got two shots in the ball. They were cost a chance at possibly tying it up, and that was the right call to me.
I was very, very frustrated, not by the play, because, you know, sometimes that happens in the heat of the moment and everything. And it's also small guy on big guy violence, which I'm vaguely sympathetic at as a small guy. But at the same time, you can't be that kind of dangerous. I mean, it really is something. And he wasn't, I mean, I'm sure his intention was to make a play on the ball, but he could have really hurt Ibaka there.
Few more notes on Philly. Robert Covington has struggled shooting the ball a little bit. He had 0 points on 0 for 6, played only 28 minutes. Nick Stauskas came back to earth. He was 1 out of 6, negative 20 for the Sixers in this one. And this is one of those things where it's like, Robert Covington is one of your best players. I thought his defense in this game was actually excellent. And he had 3 steals and 2 blocks. He's a good shooter. We know he's a good shooter. Just play him, Brett Brown. Play him 35 minutes a game in a close game where you're trying to win it. Otherwise, it's going to be Nick Stauskas to be there. Now, Hollis Thompson was outstanding in this one. He had 22 points on only 11 shooting possessions, 4 of 4 on threes, and really defended pretty well also. I thought he was great. And I think Gerald Henderson had a nice game too, getting to the foul line, not shooting any threes, of course, which is kind of too bad. And Sergio Rodriguez had 11 assists, although he did have 4 turnovers and 12 points, 2 out of 5 on threes. His three-pointer has looked pretty solid so far after we were kind of fretting about how poorly he was shooting it during the preseason. So I think really, and then Saric, so we got to talk about him too. I mean, a lot of guys on Philly played really well in this game. They just cannot get it done down the end of close games. Saric had 21 points on 15 shooting possessions and was 3 of 4 on threes. I think the biggest difference for him was just hitting his jump shot.
Well, and he looked so much more comfortable. I think that he's getting used to it. And they commented, I had the Sixers broadcast, and they were talking about how he had to, early in the game, he was looking down at the 3-point line every time to make sure that he was in the right place. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that experience, because he's playing in a new league with new rules, that experience will really help.
Rashawn Holmes, I thought, made some progress on the defensive glass. He has been a pathetic defensive rebounder in his career. And there were a few times where you could actually see him where he might have gone for the block, even someone which he would normally get because he's a fantastic shot blocker. But there was one time when I want to say it was Elfrid Payton drove, and he was pretty well covered up by his defender. I think it was Thompson. And Holmes was about to go for the block, and he said, no, I'm not going to do that. This is a tough shot. I'm just going to protect the defensive glass. And he ended up, you know, boxing his guy out, and Philly got the defensive rebound when Payton missed that tough shot. So I think little baby steps like that for him, if he can get better on the defensive glass, he's someone who I think could be a very solid backup center type in time. But turning to Orlando, Nick Vucevic destroyed them in this game. He had 5 offensive rebounds, 24 points, 11 out of 16 from the field. Of course, only 3 free throw attempts because he's Nick Vucevic, but he was too quick for Embiid getting to his pick and pop. Embiid not really quite having the experience to guard that play. And then when he was guarded by Holmes, Holmes is a little bit light for Vucevic, and he was able to just get right on in, bump him off, and shoot his accurate little hook shot, you know, pretty close to the lane. I mean, that's always the biggest thing on those hook shots, is like, your last bump, are you going to get knocked backwards a little bit and kind of have to be going parallel to the rim when you shoot, or are you actually really able to lean in and shoot that hook shot? And it was the latter situation for Vuce today.
And his plus 21 is also reflective of the idea that Philly doesn't exactly have the best drivers in the world, and so they can't exploit him in the same ways that some other teams can. And, you know, defensively, I think he was fine in this game. There were moments where I also really liked what Elfrid Payton did. He's better in transition than half court, which is wholly unsurprising considering almost every point guard, especially young point guards, are better with that space and kind of discombobulation of the defense. But there were moments where he, you know, even if the shot didn't go in, where he made the right decision. And that is something that you're really looking for with a player like him. And also, not much recklessness. I thought he did a nice job of playing within himself, and if he had really kind of pushed it and maybe forced a few more turnovers, it would have created enough easy offense for Philadelphia for them to win.
The Magic bench continues to struggle. They really had to bail out their bench in this game. Hazonia, 1 out of 4, negative 17 in only 12 minutes. Jeff Green, 1 out of 5, negative 16. Hazonia just does not seem to be making much progress. It's disappointing to me. There are minutes available for him. They desperately need shooting. and that he can't even get 15 minutes on this team that is struggling to score so badly is really disheartening to me. And then Aaron Gordon, this whole thing about him at the three, just not really quite working. He had 7 points on 10 shots, 0-4 from three, and they were just going under. You know, they were on the other side of the Delaware River going under on him. I mean, there was one play that I took a video of where Hollis Thompson was guarding him, and Gordon was at the three-point line, and Hollis Thompson was at the free throw line going under on him, and Gordon just, you know, was not even able to take advantage of that. So I think it's just this whole thing of Gordon playing at the three, they really want him to develop there. I would understand that if this were another developmental season for the Magic, but they, jobs are on the line here. They have aspirations, and I think that him playing at the three, you're really going to struggle to have an efficient offense there.
They also have these weird stretches where they play Vooch and Bismack Biyombo together, and I don't really see what the goal is there, especially when they're putting Biyombo on another team's four. I mean, yeah, he can switch and he can do certain other things, but it's like, yeah, he's also a good rim protector. Yeah. And
I mean, I think the goal is he's just better than Jeff Green, even if the fit is bad, right? Like,
yeah, but I mean, they could also go to an idea of, I know it sounds revolutionary, of using Aaron Gordon as both their starting three and backup four, and, you know, going, maybe doing a quick hook idea with him and then playing him in that role, which he can actually do.
Yeah, that's a good point too. Ibaka did have a really nice game with 21 points on only 14 shooting possessions for him, and not really doing it from the three-point line. He was able to get to the basket, get some dunks. He looked a lot better than he has early on, and even protected the rim some early, which their defense was bad at times in the first half for sure, to give up, I think it was 57-44 at halftime, but he did look at least a little bit more spry defensively for the Magic, and they got a sorely needed win. I mean, this would have been crisis time for them to go to 0-4, losing to some teams that are not really supposed to be that good as well. So at least now they're not really like, all right, we're in big trouble here.
And more than that, they also got some good performances from guys that they're going to need that from, like Elfrid Payton. I thought he did a nice job in this game, and they can build off of this, even if it was a win on the road against what we all expect to be one of the three worst teams in the league.
All right, I think we're done here. You got anything to plug before we depart?
Yeah, right before we recorded this, I did Locked On Warriors, Locked On Blazers crossover with Eric Gunderson and Dane Carbaugh, who do Locked On Blazers. And then I will have my standard player analysis, game analysis for Warriors Blazers on The Athletic. Also had a podcast with Dan Feldman on the kind of the extension deadline, similar to what we did, but we took some different angles on it. That came out, I think it was this morning. Yeah, this morning.
All right, I have nothing to plug other than my Twitter handle, at NathanDuncanNBA. And of course, our sponsors, CISO, a new sponsor. If you love comedy the way I do, you can get 2 free months with them at CISO.com, promo code CAPSPACE, of course. And then NatureBox, if you are uninspired by some of the snacking in your life, NatureBox can really help you out there. NatureBox.com/CAPSPACE. Just go and look at some of the things they have. It's very unique, interesting snacks. And you get 50% off your first order at naturebox.com/catspace. Thanks again to everyone who's given us iTunes reviews and ratings. We've been in the top 30, despite it being football season, in the iTunes professional sports ratings. That's pretty awesome for us. We're happy about that. And we thank everyone for the support. We'll be back tomorrow night. Till then.